This is Precepts Audio Message PA-264. Nathan C. Johnson, Bible Teacher. For all those who love our Lord Jesus Christ in truth.
We're on the Song of Solomon, chapter 6. And as we've been going through the Song of Solomon, we've seen that this book is written kind of like a script for a play. All we really have are the lines of the play. We don't have any notes on who the speaker is or when the scene changes or what the scene is. So we kind of have to gather that from what is said in the lines. But I believe it's a story going on. It's called a song and probably originally was to music, but the Spirit has not retained the music for us, just the words. But it's a story, and as we've seen, it's a story of a love triangle, if you will. We have this country girl, we call her the Shulamite, because that's the only real name we have for her in the book. And her lover, who's a shepherd, so we just called him the shepherd. And then Solomon, now we've seen how she was out in a garden, just looking at the produce of the garden, happened to run into Solomon on his, he is also in the garden, and he spotted her and apparently was taken by her beauty. And for once, wanted an Israelite girl instead of all the foreign women he was always marrying. He was actually on the way home from another one of his weddings when he spotted her, and he takes her along hoping to marry her. But she is betrothed to the shepherd, promised to him, and is dismayed that Solomon wants her. Now we've seen how that they arrived at Jerusalem, and in Jerusalem her shepherd came to her for the second time. He'd come to her once during their journey back to Jerusalem, and probably with the help of some sympathetic courtiers or court ladies who have felt sorry for this young girl and have taken her side, he's gotten in to see her. And the second time in Jerusalem, I believe they hit upon this desperate plan that as long as they were betrothed but not married, betrothal was official, went through a ceremony, but it could be broken up by divorce, and the divorce could be either on the part of the man involved or upon the part of the girl's family, her father usually, but this girl is in charge of her brothers, her father being dead. Well, her brothers seem not very sympathetic to her and are likely, if Solomon insists upon it, to give a divorce. So they hit upon this desperate plan that, well, it's really not the cultural thing to do to consummate the marriage during the betrothal period. It was generally agreed upon by both parties before they would come together. That really it's the only thing to do is to consummate the marriage, and then once they're actually married, only the man can divorce. And that cuts the brothers out of it, and of course the shepherd would never agree to a divorce. So they do this, consummate their relationship, and now the Shulamite is waiting for her final confrontation with Solomon, and that's what we get to starting in chapter 6. In verse 4. So verse 4. Thou art beautiful, O my love, as Tirzah, comely as Jerusalem, terrible as an army with banners. So at this point now, Solomon enters the scene. And this, of course, is his final confrontation with the Shulamite. We saw a previous confrontation while they were still on the way back to Jerusalem when he tried to win her over. And now he's back in Jerusalem. He plans on really turning on the charm. And Solomon has a lot of wives, probably figures he's a ladies' man, is able to charm this girl. Of course, he has all the advantages of being the king and being wealthy and can offer her all these things. So he's going to try to win her over. So he says, "Thou art beautiful, O my love, as Tirzah." Now Tirzah, that was a city. Name means delightful, and apparently it was a very pleasant city, very delightful city, and Solomon calls it beautiful, compares her to it, so it must have been a beautiful place. It later actually became the capital of the northern kingdom for a time before the capital settled in Samaria and remained in Samaria for the rest of the existence of the northern kingdom. But at first Tirzah was the capital for a while. So, beautiful as Tirzah, comely as Jerusalem. Now, Jerusalem, of course, was at the height of its beauty during the reign of Solomon, because he filled it with so many riches, gold and silver and jewels and so forth. Certainly was at its most beautiful, at least so far, not as beautiful as it would be in the kingdom, but it's most beautiful during Solomon's reign. Now, then he says, terrible is an army with banners. But terrible here means awe-inspiring. So we think of an army marching with their banners in decorative march, and would indeed look awe-inspiring. So this is his flatteries of her. Verse 5, turn away thine eyes from me, for they have overcome me. Thy hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Gilead. So Solomon is turning on the charm, the romance here. He's trying to win her over. We notice that her shepherd never did anything like this, but he is acting like he just can't stand her gaze anymore. Her looking at him is just overwhelming him. So he is obviously trying to impress her, trying to be romantic, act like he can't stand her eyes because they're overcoming him. Then he says, thy hair is as a flock of goats that appear from Gilead. So he compares her hair to these goats coming from Gilead. Well, that was a figure her shepherd actually used back in chapter 4. And we notice that there is some similar language between what the shepherd uses and Solomon uses. Well, I think this isn't too hard to figure out if we consider that they're both living in the same country, the same culture at around the same time. And there probably are common sayings that go around that men use to flatter their ladies or to talk up their ladies, and they get shared among the men, and so these are known. So both Solomon and the shepherd know them and use them. So it shouldn't surprise us if sometimes their figures are the same. So verse 6, thy teeth are as a flock of sheep which go up from the washing, whereof every one beareth twins, and there is not one barren among them. So now he speaks of her teeth. Well, here again we have similar language that a shepherd used back in chapter 4, verse 3. Although he says flocks rather than the Hebrew word the shepherd used was for ewes, although the King James didn't translate it that way. But Solomon uses a word just more generic, flocks. Otherwise, it's more or less the same figure. But again, they're living in the same country, the same culture, and probably things that go around that more than one person, more than these two men would use. Then verse 7, as a piece of a pomegranate are thy temples within thy locks. So again, these are words are similar to what her shepherd said, a comparison for her temples. But then notice what Solomon says in verse 8. This certainly her shepherd did not say. He says, there are 80 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. So Solomon here admits to it. He comes to the sticky point. Well, he admits that he has 60 queens and 80 concubines already. And he doesn't even seem to hide the fact that he says there are virgins without number. He seems to indicate that he has just gotten started collecting wives. And of course, we realize that that's true. He had just gotten started because he ended up with 700 queens and 300 concubines. So he has just gotten started at 60 queens and 80 concubines. Then verse 9, my dove, my undefiled, is but one. She is the only one of her mother. She is the choice one of her that bare her. The daughter saw her and blessed her, yea, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. So he admits to having 60 queens and 80 concubines, but he says, more or less, well, then I can tell, I should know. I should know, and I can tell just by looking at you that you are unique, that you are different, that you are special. Now, Solomon, in saying this, he turns what should be a very big negative, that he already has 140 women, and she'd be the 141st, and he turns that around into a positive. Well, yeah, I have all these women, but hey, that just shows that I should know, I should recognize a special woman. Well, this can't help but remind me of Satan, the one who, in the Garden of Eden, took the idea of a poison fruit and turned it around into a positive thing to tempt Eve. Well, Solomon's doing the same thing here. He takes this very negative thing turns around into a positive thing. Well, I have a lot of women, yeah, but therefore I should know women, and I can tell how special you are because I know women. So then he goes on and he says, the daughters saw her and blessed her, yea, the queens and the concubines, and they praised her. So he suggests that the queens and the concubines, when they see her, they'll all praise her. They'll all say the same thing he does, that she is special, that she is better than them, I guess. Well, I don't know how likely his statement actually is. How often a woman praises her rival, even if her rival is better than her. But I would suggest, and this is just a guess, and I've said here we try to go through and see all the things we can establish. I think we can establish his story mostly right from the text. I don't think this is something we're reading in. I think this is coming out of the text. But here is something I'll admit that I'm guessing a little bit. But he seems to be suggesting in saying that the queens and the concubines would praise her, seems to be suggesting that he could promote her to the very highest queen. And of course, the highest queen would be the one whose child would be the heir to the throne. That would make her the highest queen. Now, he seems to be suggesting this. Now, if so, I think this is his trump card. This is what he thinks will really win her. See, Solomon very much, I think, discounts a woman's love. In his experience, and of course, his experience has been with 140 women, but how special has he been to any of them? So in his experience, he doesn't expect a woman to really stand up for love, to really care who she marries as long as she can get a lot out of it. So he probably figures that she is just holding out for the best deal she can get. She's just holding out for a better deal. So he figures this is his trump card. If he offers her the highest queen position, well, that will win her heart for certain. Now, I think he might have been willing to offer that because, for one thing, I would have to imagine that Solomon's advisors would not be super happy about the heir coming from one of these many foreign women. And if Solomon had actually promoted to the highest queendom an Israelite girl, maybe his advisors are saying, aha, he's finally falling for an Israelite girl. And if he'll promote her to the highest queen, make her child the heir, well, then they would be much happier. Then they wouldn't have a king whose mother was not an Israelite, which we know is actually the way it ended up. Rehoboam, his mother was not an Israelite. She was an Ammonitess. So it could be quite possible that Solomon would be willing to do this and that his advisors would be all for it, that he would actually make an Israelite girl the highest queen. So he probably does not believe that she is really just this loyal. He thinks she's just holding out for a better deal. And so he's offering it to her, and he thinks this will win her over. So verse 10, who is she that looketh forth as the morning, fair as the moon, clear as the sun, and terrible as an army with banners? So these are the words that Solomon is suggesting for the other queens and the concubines to be saying and praising her. Well, again, I don't know how likely it is that they would actually say this. But he's pretending that they would say that she looks forth like the morning, she's as fair as the moon and clear as the sun and awe-inspiring as an army with banners. So all the other queens and concubines will be praising her, according to the picture Solomon paints. Verse 11, I went down into the garden of nuts to see the fruits of the valley, and to see whether the vine flourished and the pomegranates budded. So here is the Shulamite's reply, the girl's reply. So what she does here is that she refers back to the time when they met. She says, basically, I went down into the garden of nuts. I went into this garden, and that would be the garden where she had actually met Solomon. She says, I went down into the garden of nuts to see the fruits of the valley. She was interested in examining the nuts, the crop, how it was going, how it was coming. And then she says, and to see whether the vine flourished. Now, we know her family were vineyard keepers, and so she was interested in this. She'd grown up with this, was interested in seeing how the vines were flourishing and the pomegranates were budding. So she had just gone into this garden innocently to see the produce of the garden. She had had no thought, no premeditation that maybe I'll meet the king in this garden. She had no idea he was in the neighborhood. She just wanted to see the fruit. see how the garden was doing. So she's letting him know, meeting you in that garden was a mistake. It wasn't a plan. I wasn't trying to flirt with you or come to the attention of the king. It was just a mistake. It was just a chance meeting. So verse 12, wherever I was aware, my soul made me like the chariots of Amminadab. So she says, before she realized it, she had come upon the chariots of the noble people of her land. That's the meaning of Amminadab. So before she knew it, suddenly she had run into Solomon's entourage, his cavalcade, the chariots of the noble people of her land, the noble chariots. There was, surprise, surprise, there were Solomon's chariots. There was his procession, and she had run into it when she just innocently gone into this garden. So she explains, it was a chance meeting. I had no intention of meeting you, and I certainly didn't want to marry you or have you fall in love with me. It was just a mistake. So verse 13. Return, return, O Shulamite. Return, return, that we may look upon thee. What will ye see in the Shulamite? As it were, the company of two armies. Well, at this point, it seems that having explained herself to Solomon, that she never had any intention of meeting him, or any plan in it, that it was just a mistake, she turns around and tries to leave. So she's leaving, she's made her explanation and is leaving. But Solomon doesn't let her leave. He calls after her and calls her back, saying, return, return, O Shulamite. So here's where you get the name I've been calling her throughout the study, the Shulamite, rather than just calling her the girl the whole time. He calls her the Shulamite. Now, Shulam apparently is the city where she's from, or the small country town where she's from. It would appear. Now, we don't really know of a city named Shulam in Israel. It's not mentioned anywhere else. Some people think it might be a variant of the name Shunem, which we know was a city in Israel. I don't see how I can know that for sure. But it would seem to be her hometown. Now, Shulamite actually means the perfect or the peaceful. So some people have suggested that this actually wasn't the name of her town. It was just a flattering name Solomon was calling her, that he was calling her perfect or peaceful. So someone suggests this wasn't the town where she was from. Well, maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. But at least, like I said, it's the best name we have for her, so that's what I've been calling her throughout. And I would tend to think that it was her hometown. And she was definitely from the country, so if her hometown was so small we don't even know about it, it wouldn't be surprising. But I would prefer to think she's from Shulam. It is possible she's not, and this is just another flattery. So he says, return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon thee. So he says he wants to look at her. He wants to see her. He wants to gaze on her. Well, she asked, what will ye see in the Shulamite? What's so great about me? What do you want to look at me for? Is what she says. She has no desire to hear any more of his flatteries. She's trying to put him off, and she's trying to get out of there. But he doesn't want to let her go. So she says, what will you see? What do you want to look at? So Solomon jumps right back into his trying to win her. He says, as it were, the company of two armies. Now, the word here is Mahanaim. And apparently what he says is that what he wants to see is like the view of Mahanaim. Now, as far as I can tell, I don't think it's talking about two armies, but it's talking about some overlook, maybe called the two armies, that had an extremely beautiful view. Because remember, this is some kind of flattery. So he says, looking at you is like looking at the view from Mahanaim, seems to be what he's saying. So, verse 1, chapter 7. How beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O prince's daughter! The joints of thy thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman. So Solomon, again, is continuing with his flatteries. It started out in the end of chapter 6 there. She's like the view from Mahanaim. That's what he wants to look at. And so now he's describing the view as he looks at her. He says, how beautiful are thy feet with shoes. Now that would be sandals, of course. They didn't wear clothes, toed shoes like we wear. How beautiful are thy feet with sandals, O prince's daughter. or noble maiden. Now there, of course, he's flattering her because she's just a country girl, but he's calling her a noble maiden, and again trying to intimate that this is what she'll become if she marries him, the very highest of nobility, the queen. Then he says, "The joints of thy thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a cunning workman," or the Hebrew would be hands of steadiness. In other words, a skilled workman, because only a skilled workman could have steady enough hands to form such beautiful thighs. Then verse 2. "Thy navel is like a round goblet, which wanteth not liquor. Thy belly is like an heap of wheat set about with lilies." So he praises her navel like a goblet with spiced wine. And then he praises her belly like a heap of wheat set about with lilies. So here he's outdoing himself and flattering her. And I think here what he's trying to do, since his attempt to stir up her avarice, her greed for the queenship position, desire for power and prestige doesn't seem to have worked. Now he seems to be resorting to the baser appeal of just appealing to her hormones. He's trying to stir her up. He's trying to stir up her passion for him. And so he is really turning up the heat, if you will, on the romantic sexual language here in describing her. So verse 3, "Thy two breasts are like two young roes that are twins." Now here we have the same poetic figure for breasts that we saw her shepherd use back in chapter 4. Again, probably a typical figure at the time. Then verse 4, "Thy neck is as a tower of ivory, thine eyes like the fish pools in Heshbon, by the gate of Beth Rabim. Thy nose is as the tower of Lebanon, which looketh toward Damascus." So he compares her neck to an ivory tower. Of course, we're all aware even today of the figure of an ivory tower as being something that's beautiful. Then he describes her eyes like the fish pools of Heshbon. Heshbon was a city's stronghold, is its name. It was a city east of the Jordan. It was actually where, when the Israelites came in, were conquering the land, Sihon, the king of the Amorites, had his capital at Heshbon. So it was the capital of one of those nations east of the Jordan that Israel conquered. So apparently, there were fish pools in Heshbon by the gate of Beth Rabim, or daughter of multitudes. So apparently there's this gate at Heshbon by this that has fish pools by it. Solomon has probably been there. And doubtful, it was a very beautiful place, and these fish pools were very beautiful pools. Solomon has been all over Israel and seen, probably other places in the world as well, seen all the best and the most beautiful places. And maybe these fish pools were known for being beautiful, even if people hadn't seen them. So he compares her eyes to these fish pools. Now next, he compares her nose to the Tower of Lebanon. Now, I think it's pretty doubtful in our day and in our culture that any man would try to flatter a woman by comparing her nose to a tower. Women will tend to be a little bit sensitive about the idea of a big nose. But apparently in Israel, it was not such a bad thing to flatter a woman by saying her nose was a tower. Maybe large noses were considered attractive, or long noses. So he compares her nose to a tower. Apparently that was fine at the time. Now Lebanon, we know, was in Phoenicia. It was a forest. It was west of Syria, whose capital was Damascus. So Tower of Lebanon looks toward Damascus, apparently situated toward Damascus, so it would face to the east. Then verse 5, "Thine head upon thee is like Carmel, and the hair of thine head like purple. The king is held in the galleries." So he compares her head then to the beautiful Mount Carmel. And of course, we're familiar with Mount Carmel. That was the mountain where Elijah had his showdown with the prophets of Baal and Asherah. So then he compares her hair to the purple of purple cloth, the royal color. Of course, her hair was black, like most Israelites' hair would have been. But he says it's like purple. It's like the kingly color, the royal color, her hair. And then the king is held in the galleries or captivated by the ringlets of her hair. Apparently she has ringlets, curly hair. And he's captivated by the ringlets in her hair, he says. Of course, by the king, he means himself. Verse 6, how fair and how pleasant art thou, O love, for delights. Now here he is actually not speaking to her and calling her his love, but he is speaking of love abstractly. He's making an aside, a soliloquy to love. And he calls love fair and charming, how fair and charming love is. And this is the kind of thing I imagine some rather snobbish person considered cultured would soliloquize love and say this about love. Ah, oh, love is so fair and pleasant. And he inserts this into his flatteries. Well, again, he's trying to stir up her passion. He's trying to stir up her hormones, her sexual desire. And so he makes this aside about just how wonderful love is. So makes this aside to love. Very cultured Solomon is in his polygamy. But very cultured, at least he imagines himself so, I suppose. Then verse 7. This thy stature is like to a palm tree, and thy breast to clusters of grapes. So he compares her standing before him. Again, remember, he's describing the view like the view from Mahanaim that he sees when he looks at her. And so he says her standing there is like a palm tree. And then he compares her breast to clusters of grapes. In verse 8, I said, I will go up to the palm tree. I will take hold of the boughs thereof. Now also thy breast shall be as clusters of the vine, and the smell of thy nose like apples. So he wishes to go to the palm tree and take hold of its boughs, of course meaning her. And her breast will be like clusters of grapes, and her smell like apples. Well, here he is anticipating making love to her, again trying to stir this up. So verse 9, and the roof of thy mouth like the best wine for my beloved, that goeth down sweetly, causing the lips of those that are asleep to speak. So he compares her palate to the best wine. So he is, again, trying to stir up the passion and suggest that they should make love. But the Shulamite breaks in and says, that goeth down sweetly for my beloved, causing the lips of those that are asleep to speak. So in other words, saying, this wine is for my beloved. And in fact, then in verse 10, she reveals that it's already gone down for her beloved. She already belongs to him. Verse 10. I am my beloved's, and his desire is toward me. So Solomon has been stirring this up all to a fever pitch, a climax, hoping to stir her up to passion. But this has worked no more than his appeal to her greed and desire for power or fame worked. Now it's clear to her that Solomon is not going to take a no for an answer. Now she has tried, I believe, to save her trump card. And she doesn't want to play this and doesn't want to humiliate Solomon by playing this card, but it seems he's leaving her no choice. He's getting very amorous at this point. And so she's forced to play her trump card, I believe. And she says, I am my beloved's. Now, she said this before, I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine. But speaking of betrothal, I think here she reveals to him the fact that she and her beloved have now consummated their relationship. Now, that was her last-ditch effort, her final card to play, because having consummated their relationship, it now means that only her beloved could write out the proper paperwork, could make the decision to make a divorce. And of course, he is not going to do that. So she reveals to him that they have already consummated their relationship and that she belongs to her beloved. And she says, his desire is toward me. He wants me to be with him and I want to return to him. Verse 11, come, my beloved, let us go forth into the field, let us lodge in the villages. Now, once she reveals this, we hear no more from Solomon. Now, my guess would be that Solomon has probably exited the scene in great anger. Needless to say, he does not like this last revelation. And so she is left to wait in nervous anticipation for what is going to come next. Now, she is, of course, in the hands, completely in the power of the king. And she doesn't know what he's going to do to her. Of course, David was not exactly kind to Uriah when in attempting to get what he wanted. And she doesn't know what Solomon might or might not do now that she has revealed this to him. So she is left to nervously wait and see what's going to happen. But while she's waiting, she speaks in absentia, of course, to her beloved. And speaks to herself, to her desire, to go with him. She says, "Come, my beloved, let us go forth into the field. Let us lodge in the villages." She wants to leave Jerusalem. She has no desire to be here in the big city. She wants to go forth with her beloved into the field and lodge in the villages, lodge in the small towns, in the country villages. Verse 12, "Let us get up early to the vineyards. Let us see if the vine flourish, whether the tender grape appear, and the pomegranates bud forth. There will I give thee my loves." So she wants to get up early in the morning and go out into the vineyards with her beloved, not alone like she had done when she accidentally ran into Solomon, but with him, and to see with him if the vines flourish and the grapes appear and the pomegranates bud. And then alone with her shepherd, she will give him her loves, her endearments, is what that means. Verse 13, "The mandrakes give a smell, and at our gates are all manner of pleasant fruits, new and old, which I have laid up for thee, O my beloved." So the mandrakes give a smell. The mandrakes are thought to promote fertility, as we can see in the story of Jacob and Rachel and Leah, where Leah buys a night with Jacob for mandrakes, giving mandrakes to Rachel. And they were thought to promote fertility. So the mandrakes give a smell. It's probably speaking of her desire, her anticipation of having children with her shepherd. And she says, our gateways are all manner of pleasant fruits. And she says she has reserved these fruits, both new and old, for her beloved and for him alone, and not for Solomon. So now chapter 8 and verse 1. "Oh, that thou wert as my brother, that sucked the breasts of my mother. When I should find thee without, I would kiss thee. Yea, I should not be despised." Now, as time goes on and as the moments pass, she is getting more and more apprehensive. Of course, she has laid down her trump card before Solomon. She doesn't know what he's going to do. And like I said, probably her heart is pounding, and maybe she's sat down. She can barely stand because she is, quite frankly, she's tried to match wits with the king of Israel and has done battle with the king of Israel. And now it remains to be seen what's going to become of her, because you generally do not want to defy the king. And here she is, just a young girl, and she's defied him. So she is apprehensive what's going to happen to her. And she wishes her beloved was with her. That's why she has been speaking to him in her imagination, imagining going forth with him back out into the familiar and comfortable country, away from the city and Solomon's palace altogether. So now she says, "Oh, that you were as my brother. Oh, that you were my brother." She says, if her shepherd was just her brother, then she says, "When I should find thee without, I would kiss thee. Yea, I should not be despised." So she says, if you were my brother, when I met you in public, I could kiss you and have no reproach. Now, this is really a rather childish and somewhat despairing wish, because I think it's pretty clear that she doesn't really want a sisterly relationship with her shepherd. She wants to be his wife. She doesn't want to be his sister. But, like I said, this is almost a despairing wish. She's afraid she's going to lose him, and she'd rather have him as a brother than not at all. Now remember, this girl is probably quite young. And as much as we understand it, a typical age for marrying in Israel would have been about 15. Now that seems very young and inappropriate to us, But we have to realize that that's just our culture. And the fact is that even in our country, in what we call the Wild West, if a woman reached 16 and was not married in some places, or at least attached, going to be married, by 16 she was considered an old maid. So women getting married at 15 in the Wild West was not unusual in our own country, and that wasn't more than about 150 years ago. So we shouldn't think it's strange that a woman would get married at about 15. So this girl is probably about 15 years old, and that's very young. So she is just a young girl, and she's been thrust into this very, very scary and uncomfortable situation where she has had to defy the king and doesn't know what's going to happen to her. So we see her childish wish here, but I think in the situation we can understand. She wishes her beloved was with her, and if she can't be married to him, she wishes he were her brother, and she could kiss him in public, and no one would despise her for doing so. So then verse 2, I would lead thee and bring thee into my mother's house, who would instruct me. I would cause thee to drink of spiced wine of the juice of my pomegranate. So she again is imagining herself in this situation where he is like her brother, where she would lead him and bring him into her mother's house. Of course, she had done that when they had their date, or whatever you want to call it, back in chapter 3. She'd taken him to her mother's house, made her mother her ally, since her brothers were trying to get in the way of her relationship. And then in her mother's house, her mother would instruct her, of course, regarding their relationship, as her mother probably already had done. And then she would serve her shepherd the spiced wine and the juice of my pomegranate. So she would serve her shepherd pomegranate juice there. Then in verse 3, his left hand should be under my head, and his right hand should embrace me. So she wishes to be in his embrace, as we saw back in chapter 1, or wishing she would be in his embrace. So verse 4, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that ye stir not up, nor wake my love until he please. So what happens here, if the court ladies start to file in, maybe they're coming to try to see what happened. Now they realize Solomon isn't there. They're coming in to see what happened. Is he going to let you go? Is he going to force you to marry him? What's going to happen? So she makes one last charge to them. She charges them, the daughters of Jerusalem, not to stir up or awake her love until she please. Again, she's speaking of her love, not of her shepherd. She's speaking of her love and saying, don't try to wake my love for Solomon. Now, she said this before. This time she shortens it and leaves out the part about the rose and the hinds of the field. Well, I think she is, like I said, very upset and speaks this shortened form of it. Don't try to stir up my love for Solomon. It's no use. It's not going to happen. Well, at this point, we have the break, and we have a scene change. So, verse 5. Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved? I raised thee up unto the apple tree. There thy mother brought thee forth. There she brought thee forth that bare thee. So we're left here, basically, the scene changes, and we see the Shulamite and her shepherd returning home. So we're left, the curtain closes without us seeing really what happens when she leaves Jerusalem. Now I imagine that Solomon, realizing that he's been stymied, she doesn't want him, and she's already consummated the relationship with her shepherd, so there's no way for him to get a divorce now, force her family into divorce, and realizes her shepherd is not going to agree to it. So, considering he realizes there's nothing he can do but let her go, so he has to let her go. Now, I don't imagine he let her go very gently. Probably, we've already seen how she was decked out with gold and jewels and so forth. I would imagine those were taken away from her. The finery was taken away from her, and maybe taken right quite roughly from her. Maybe they ripped the jewels off of her. Maybe they tore off her clothes and threw on her the country clothes she had had at first, or some old rags they had lying around, or who knows. Maybe they dragged her out of the palace and kicked her out the door into a mud puddle or something. But however they treated her, I think she would have kissed the ground, been happy just to be out, to be free, to go back to her shepherd. So whatever rough treatment she got leaving, I think it was all joy to her because it meant she was free and she should go back to her shepherd. Now, any rough treatment she received would not be unusual, because we too, as I said, in as we dwell in this world and in the very enemy's camp, the camp of Satan, the prince of the power of this atmosphere, when our shepherd comes to us and wins our love and we become his, this world seldom treats us well. It often has nothing good to say about us. It often treats us quite roughly. But it's all joy to us because we have our shepherd. So however she was treated, well, now she's free. So I think she was happy. I imagine she got some rough treatment. Maybe I called a harlot and who knows what, kicked out the door, but she's free, heads back to her beloved. So whatever the case, whatever happened there, and like I said, we can just imagine it. What we next see in verse 5 is the opposite of what we saw back at the end of chapter 3, verses 6 through 13. There we saw the people in Jerusalem noticing Solomon's caravan as it approached. Here we see the people back in the country, in their small town, in the place where they live. And who this is, Ginsburg imagines it's the shepherd's companions. Maybe it is, maybe it's the townspeople in the town where she lives, maybe it's her family. But it's someone back in their hometown, and they see someone coming. Now in Jerusalem they saw someone coming, and it was Solomon's train. Here they see someone coming, and they say, "Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness?" The exact same thing that the Jerusalemites said back in chapter 3 and verse 6. Now remember, though, in chapter 3, they were seeing Solomon's procession. Solomon was returning from his wedding. And what did they all notice? Well, they noticed this palanquin. And they noticed the perfume that they were all wearing. You could smell the perfumes as they approached. And they all noticed the valiant men gathered around Solomon's sedan chair. And they noticed how richly this sedan chair was furnished. And they noticed the crown Solomon was wearing and how beautiful his new crown was. And not a single one of them noticed this new queen. Nobody noticed her, nobody cared. But how different it is when this girl returns from the wilderness back home. They say, "Who is this that cometh up from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved?" So all eyes in this case turn to the girl. All eyes in this case turn to the Shulamite. All eyes turn to her, as it should be. A new bride shouldn't be considered like a cow. Nobody cares. All eyes should be turning to the new bride, and all eyes turn to her. And they say, "Who is this coming up leaning upon her beloved?" That's what they notice. Not a sedan chair, not perfume, not a crown, not the honor guard. The girl. And that's as it should be. That's who they notice. So they're coming back home. Now she speaks to her beloved. "I raised thee up under the apple tree." Now what that means is, I raised up your love, basically. Now she is referring back to when they first met. Of course, any romantic story, the first meeting has to be something special. And she had met him under an apple tree, or Bullinger suggests better would be an orange tree. So they had met under this tree, and in some places in Israel, trees are not too common. There are forests in Israel, but there are plains as well. And in the plains, of course, a tree is a notable thing. So this was the orange tree, the significant orange tree in the area. Well, they had met, and she had caused him to fall in love with her under this orange tree. It says, "There thy mother brought thee forth. There she brought thee forth that bare thee." Well, interestingly, the very orange tree under which they met had been where her mother had given birth to the shepherd. Now that was not too unusual. They would have outdoor births at the time. Because remember, when you were giving birth, you were unclean. So any building, any room you gave birth in would become unclean. So it could be convenient to give birth outdoors, because then you aren't making any room unclean by being in it when you're giving birth. So he had actually been born under this orange tree, and under this very orange tree, his love for her had been born as well. So very romantic. And verse 6, set me as a seal upon thine heart, as a seal upon thine arm, for love is strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. The coals thereof are coals of fire, which hath a most vehement flame. So now in verses 6 and verse 7, we get, really, I think, the themes, the major themes of this book stated here. This is really stating the theme of this book and what the message of the book really is. And first we get in verse 6, she says, set me as a seal upon thine heart. This would be a seal, would be a signet, a signet ring. And this was something that was often given to indicate a covenant, an agreement. I suppose we could think of it kind of like our wedding ring. Back then, writing was not so common, your signature on a contract, so the signet ring could be the sign of a contract. Well, not too unusual for us, we do the same thing with wedding ring. Of course, we have a signed marriage certificate as well. But set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. So make me, I am your signet, she says. Then she says, for love is strong as death. Of course, death, at least in this world, until the kingdom, death does not let you go. Once death has you, it doesn't let you go. And, you know, only God can reverse death, and only in the resurrection to come will death be reversed. So love is strong as death. Once love has you, it doesn't let you go. Then jealousy is cruel as the grave. Now why is she bringing jealousy in here? She's proclaiming her love for her shepherd. Why would she bring up jealousy? He has no reason to be jealous. She has no reason to be jealous. Well, I think in the context of this book, it's clear what is meant by jealousy. Being inexorable as the grave. Jealousy, what it means here is the desire for marital exclusivity. The jealousy being referred to is the desire for marital exclusivity. And of course, that's a natural and an understandable desire that anyone would have, the desire to be exclusive for marital exclusivity. Now, what had Solomon done? Well, of course, he had absolutely trampled on marital exclusivity. He had ground it under his feet and spat on it, if you will. But jealousy, the desire for marital exclusivity, is cruel as the grave and should not be cruel, should be inexorable as the grave. And it says, the coals thereof are coals of fire. The coals of love, love is like a fire. And the desire for marital exclusivity is like a fire which has a most vehement flame. Now here, the translation is a little bit regrettable. What the Hebrew reads is Shal Habeth Yah. Shal Habeth Yah. And Yah, we recognize, is actually common in many names. Of course, we often have it as Yah, not Yah with a J. But it's short for Yahweh, or Yah short for Jehovah. But Shal Habeth Yah. So it means not a vehement flame, but literally flames of Yah, flames of the Lord. So what is this saying? I believe that this is saying that love and the desire for marital exclusivity is a fire that is kindled by the Lord. Those flames are the Lord's fire. Love and the desire for exclusivity is the Lord's fire. The Lord's fire. Now, what has Solomon done when he has trampled on marital exclusivity? Solomon has quenched the Lord's fire. Now, of course, we can't just blame Solomon. His father had done the same thing. And many others in Israel had done the same thing. Solomon wasn't the first one to do this. He didn't invent it. Now, Solomon had taken it to the biggest extreme we have anybody take it to in the Bible, certainly. He had taken the bad example from his father and from his culture and run with it and taken it to absolutely absurd lengths. But that is what he's done, and that's what any polygamist has done, is that he has quenched the Lord's fire, because it's the Lord who kindles the desire for marital exclusivity. And so Solomon has quenched the Lord's fire. Now, the thing is that it's not just this exclusivity that Solomon quenches. Because we realize that there are two relationships in a person's life that should be exclusive. One is husband and wife. That relationship should be exclusive. You can love, you can have love for a lot of people. God wants us to love people. But there's only one person who should be your marriage partner. That should be exclusive. You can love other people, but not like your marriage partner. That needs to be exclusive. And the second one, of course, is God. That should be exclusive. You should only have one God. And the desire for marital exclusivity should be equaled or surpassed by the desire for theologic, if you will, exclusivity. The desire to have only one God and to reserve yourself for only one God. Now, Solomon, we know, not only quenches marital exclusivity, he also quenches exclusivity regarding God, because later on he is led astray by his foreign wives to create idols to their gods. So Solomon quenches the Lord's fire. And that this is really the sweeping condemnation of polygamy. And again, Solomon is not the only one guilty. His father was guilty. His whole culture, society was guilty. But they were guilty of quenching the Lord's fire. And let's face it, Israel did not just quench exclusivity in marriage. They quenched exclusivity in gods. Over and over and over again they did when they left the Lord and worshipped idols. So they were quenching the Lord's fire, and they were doing it constantly. And this is the condemnation of it. You, whether it's polygamy or idolatry, you are quenching the Lord's fire. That's what Solomon had done. So that's theme number one of the book, quenching the Lord's fire. Now, theme number two is in verse 7. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. If a man would give all the substance of his house for love, it would utterly be contemned. So many waters cannot quench love, neither can the floods drown it. So natural things can't put out love. Love, you say love is like a fire, but water can quench a fire, but it can't quench love. Earthly powers can't quench love. Now Solomon, he had offered everything he could offer. All the wealth of his house, all the glory of his kingship, and the idea of being a queen, an heir to the throne, all this, he had offered it. He had offered all the substance of his house if only this girl would give up on love. But his offer had been utterly despised. And the fact is, compared to love, all the goods one's house, even a house like Solomon's, will be despised compared to love. So love, that's the other theme of the book, real love. Marital exclusivity and how Israel and Solomon especially had quenched it. And then love, and that love, real love, can't be quenched. And so I think here we have the explanation of the title, the Song of Songs. Now I don't know, I've never heard this song put to music. Maybe it was the greatest song ever. But I don't think when it calls this the Song of Songs that it's necessarily referring to the book. I think it's referring to love. That love is the Song of Songs. The greatest of all songs is love. Whatever music it's put to, whatever couple it is that's singing, it could be a man and his wife, or it could be a man and his God. But love is the Song of Songs. And I think that's the other theme of the book, is love. Marital exclusivity and how Solomon had dishonored it. And that was really something that belonged to the Lord. And then love. Compared to Solomon's counterfeit version of love, real love is the Song of Songs. A song that Solomon had never sung and never would sing. So love is the Song of Songs. So here too in verse 6, before we leave the theme here, I want to point out that a lot of people, one charge the level against this book is that it doesn't have the name of God in it anywhere. I think we have it right here when it says the flames of Yah. I think God's name is there. It's not translated that way in the King James or in a lot of the versions, which is why people think the name of God isn't here. But I think it is here. I think the only book we have in the Bible that doesn't have the name of God in it is Esther. But there too, I think it might be there if we look a little bit deeper, but we aren't studying Esther right now. But yes, the name of God is there, and it's there in the theme, the two theme verses, verses 6 and 7 here of chapter 8. But now going on to verse 8, we have, I guess you could say, falling action here. It says, "We have a little sister, and she hath no breasts. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she shall be spoken for?" So now we wonder, what's going to happen to this couple? They're going back to the country. Well, we're taken back before all this, and this is really chronologically the first thing that happens in the book, but we're only being told about it now, and that is we have her brothers talking. Probably their father just died, and they are now taking over the family and deciding how to dispose of and take charge of everything involved in the family. And so now they're discussing, we have a little sister. So now what are they going to do with their little sister now that they're in charge of the family? So they say, "We have a little sister and she has no breasts." Well, that is their very very physical way of describing the fact that she has not hit puberty yet. She's not a marital age, basically. Not ready for marriage. Is that she doesn't have breasts. She's not developed yet. So say, "What shall we do for our sister in the day when she shall be spoken for?" What are we going to do with our sister now? Now that we're in charge of the family, or our father's dead. So what do we do with her? And here's what they come up with. Verse 9, "If she be a wall, we will build upon her a palace of silver. And if she be a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar." So what are they saying here? Well, they say if she's a wall, and a wall keeps people out. So that's talking of her being chaste. If she is a wall, then we will build upon her a palace of silver. We'll enrich her. We'll give her a fine dowry, a fine parent payment at her marriage to set her up in a comfortable life. But then they said if she be a door, and of course a door lets anybody in. So that is, if she's not chaste, then we will enclose her with boards of cedar. We'll shut her up in cedar. We'll just shut her up in wood, not give her any riches, not have to give her any fine dowry. We'll just shut her up if she's not chaste. Now, that's a very nice way to put it all on her, when really they are now in charge of the family and it's supposed to be their job to train her in purity. And here they're just saying, well, we'll just see how she turns out. Well, that sounds familiar to the way some people do it today. I remember one guy at work who was complaining about his daughter, his high school daughter, and the loser boyfriend she had that was living with her in his house. So his daughter's boyfriend is living in his house with her, and he's complaining about him and what a loser he is and what a bad guy she picked. And I'm thinking, don't you realize it was your job to teach her the guy, kind of guy to pick? Not to mention that it's not your job to run a brothel for this loser. You have the power to kick him out, but this guy seems to have no concept of this, that it's his fault that his daughter picks a bad guy or anything. So, shouldn't surprise us in our society. But I don't think their society was necessarily that way, but I think here again we see that her brothers don't care about her like they should. So they're just saying, oh, however she turns out, if she's chaste, we'll give her a good payment. If she's not, we'll just shut her up and keep her closed up. Then we won't have to spend money on her. So I think they'd maybe rather she wasn't chaste, because then they wouldn't have to give her a rich dowry. So verse 10, "I am a wall, and my breasts like towers. Then was I in his eyes as one that found favor." So she has basically come back with her shepherd, and she is now reminding them of this. Apparently they didn't just say this to each other, they had told this to her, that this was the deal. If she was chaste, they would enrich her. If she wasn't, they would shut her up. So she says, well, guess what? I'm a wall. I'm not a door, I'm a wall. I was chaste. Then she says, and look, my breasts are like towers. I'm definitely past puberty now. I'm developed, I'm mature, I'm a marriageable age, in other words. He says, then was I in his eyes as one that found favor, referring, of course, to her shepherd, now her husband. Verse 11, "Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard unto keepers. Every one for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver." So she is now giving her reasons why she is a wall and why she deserves the rich reward that they had promised her. And she explains that Solomon had a vineyard. I think she's using vineyard in a picturesque way for his harem. So Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon, which means the Lord of Abundance. Well, Solomon definitely was the Lord of Abundance when it came to women, because he had definitely had an abundance in his harem. So he had this vineyard at Baal Hamon, at the Lord of Abundance. He let out the vineyard onto keepers. This is probably his keepers in charge of his harem. And he says, every one for the fruit thereof was to bring 1,000 pieces of silver. Well, I take it back. This doesn't look to be the eunuchs. This appears to be those he is marrying. And apparently this is the bridal price he's giving for anyone he marries. He's giving 1,000 pieces of silver. Well, that was a rich bridal price, and certainly a lot of fathers were probably more than willing to give their daughters to Solomon as long as he was going to give them 1,000 pieces of silver. So he's letting out the fruit of his vineyard. In other words, he's allowing access to his harem for 1,000 pieces of silver. Verse 12, my vineyard, which is mine, is before me. Thou, O Solomon, must have 1,000, and those that keep the fruit thereof, 200. So she says, my vineyard is in front of me. Her vineyard is her shepherd. And he doesn't have a harem, he has hers. Her vineyard is hers and hers alone. Marital exclusivity. No sharing with anyone who will pay 1,000 pieces of silver. And she shares her shepherd with no other woman. So she says, Solomon can keep his 1,000, he can have his 1,000 wives. And whether she says this at the time, maybe it was even known that Solomon had this as a goal. Maybe he wanted to collect 1,000 women, I don't know. Seems a pretty round number for him to have collected, so maybe he was trying for that. And it was known, and he got there. So Solomon must have his 1,000, and those to keep the fruit thereof, 200. So who are these keepers of the fruit? Well, maybe they're his nobles. Now, I imagine Solomon being a polygamist, he could hardly keep his nobles and the high people in his court from being polygamists as well. So he was probably handing out wives left and right to his favored men as well. So he says, well, Solomon can have his 1,000, those that keep the fruit thereof, 200. So she says, he can have it. He can have his harem, he can have all his women. I have my vineyard. It's my shepherd, and I don't have to share him with anybody. So that's her argument. This is why she was a wall. She didn't give herself out to Solomon for anything. She reserved herself for her betrothed. And so she deserves the silver, not the cedar boards. Now, doesn't say what her brothers did, but I imagine if they were at all honest, that they had to give her the price they had promised on. She says, come through on your deal. I think they probably had little choice. They had to come through on their deal, so they gave her and her shepherd the money they needed to set up their family now. So verse 13, thou that dwellest in the gardens, the companions hearken to thy voice, cause me to hear it. So now we have one last speech from her shepherd. And the shepherd speaks to his love. And they are now, notice, they're dwelling among the gardens. They're dwelling in the country, not the palaces of Jerusalem. He says his companions are listening to her voice. They're listening to her speak, and they want to hear her speak, so he asks her to speak. Now, I don't think he just wants to hear her voice, but he wants to hear her speak, her love for him. So he says, let me hear your voice. Let me hear it. Let me hear of your love. And so if someone asked you, let me hear of your love for the Lord Jesus Christ, would you be able to speak? What would you say? If he asked, tell me of your love for me. Let me hear it. Well, I think he wants to hear it. The shepherd wants to hear it. So verse 14, he wants to hear it, and she says it. Make haste, my beloved, and be thou like a roe, like to a roe or to a young hart upon the mountains of spices. So she lets him hear it. She owns him as her one and only beloved. And he is to hurry to her side over the mountains of spices. Spices meaning delights. Remember, before she wanted him to hurry to her across the mountains of Bether, or the mountains of separation. But now there's no more separation. Now it's the mountains of delight. And she wants him ever and always to hurry to her side and to be with her from now on. So the couple ends in wedded bliss. And Solomon and his court and all his women are left behind. And they are left happily married in the country and exclusive to each other. No other one to interfere. So that brings us to the end of the Song of Solomon. And love, indeed, is the Song of Songs. So it's a great book. I think it teaches some great lessons, as we've seen here in this last chapter. And may they be lessons we all learn and appreciate. Not just about love and marriage, but also about our relationship to our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ as well.